Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Raven Cast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I'm here with my dear friend and colleague at the Raven Review, Lindsay Paris Lopez. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Adam.
I am so excited because last week we continued our seven stories discussion of Tony Bartlett's book, Seven Stories, How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible. And we had two special guests last week, Tony and Linda Bartlett. And that was a whole lot of fun talking with them about the book and how it developed. And we even talked a lot about chapter 5 in that conversation with them, which was titled, what was the title of chapter 5? Victim to Vindication. So that was chapter 5, and we had special guests for that, and that was a lot of fun.
It was great to see Tony, and I think this is the first time I've virtually met Linda, so that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was great. So if you are watching this and thinking, oh, this should be chapter 5, well, go back and listen to the other one, because last week we had that great conversation, and I'm excited for this week because we're going to have another great conversation, Lindsay, about the temple and its deconstruction. So this is going to be a lot of fun because Jesus kind of does this throwdown with the temple. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. And this is one of the reasons that I love Jesus, because he just tells it like it is when he goes up into the temple. And it's a lot of fun. And Tony does this really great job of talking about the temple and how Jesus is deconstructing it and reconstructing something totally new. So I'm excited to talk about that. But before we do, I just want to remind everybody that the Raven Cast is a product of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we talk about mimetic theory and the violence and rivalry that so often divides our lives, our communities, our nations, and our world. And we seek to come up with peaceful solutions. So, and how to understand all of these divisions within our world through the lens of mimetic theory. And Tony's book, Seven Stories, How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible, is a wonderful example of how to do this. So we're having these great discussions on it. So it's awesome. So today, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, this is an amazing book. As we get into it, the story of the temple is a big one. And I've heard the reinterpretations of it that we get into. You know, I've heard critiques and I've heard different understandings of it. And I thought I knew this story really, really well. I thought I knew the mimetic theory take on this story really well. And Tony adds more elements to it that I never considered, connects more dots that I never even saw before. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's an exciting journey that Tony brings us on. And one of the great things about what Tony does is he takes us through the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament. He does this throughout the book, and it's what I love so much. And he shows like the different views that the writers of the Hebrew Bible have when it comes to all of these different important topics. And one of the important topics is the temple. And right from the very beginning, you have these different views of the temple and of kingship, and they're related. So Tony helps us understand how politics and religion, the temple and the kingship are related here, and how the Bible tells different stories about them. So in 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, Tony says there's this kind of ambivalence about the temple. In fact, it seems as though, and along with kingship too, that God is saying, okay, you can have these, but it's not necessarily good for you. So like the prime time for Israel is under King David. Right. And David, there is no temple. Right. So God just kind of travels with the people in a tabernacle, and God is free. God's not confined to anything. And this is kind of in 2 Samuel and Kings, this is seen as the ideal time. And then Solomon builds the temple. And the reason that David isn't able to build the temple is because God says there's too much blood on your hands. So right here, God says, hey, you know what? I don't want the temple to be this place of blood and violence. I want it to be created by your son, who at this time has more innocence. So, and Solomon means, the name Solomon means peace. It's connected to shalom. So this is supposed to be something that brings about peace, not something that brings about violence in the name of God. So that's just like this really cool critique of what the temple became right there early in the Bible. And even in like kingship, you get in Second Samuel and First Kings, you get this, the people demand a king. And the prophet says, okay, since you're demanding it, you're going to become like all the other nations. Your king is going to send you to war and you're not going to like it. But if you demand it, then we'll have it. You know, it's kind of this like reluctance to have a kingship and to have the temple. And Tony brings out this really great point that they're connected. So the temple becomes this place of status quo, of holding up the powers and the principalities that come in Jerusalem.
Wow. That's, I mean, I saw that, but I think you just sort of opened my eyes again. And I think my eyes were prepared to be opened by Tony's book, but the idea that David was not allowed to build a temple because of the blood on his hands, that's just really powerful. I mean, stop and think about that for a moment, because the temple is a very bloody place. You know, the temple is, I mean, it's about religious power and authority. And it's also about political identity, having a place in the world, and the way that they feel connected to God, and the way they have their unifying rituals so that they know that they are who they are as a people is through sacrifice. And it's through sacrifice that's very detailed and very ordered and prescribed. I mean, they assumed it was prescribed by God. Mm-hmm. And yet sacrifice is a very bloody, bloody business. And for God to say, you can't build this temple because you had blood on your hands, so your son will build it.
Yeah, it's like this critique right there in the Bible of what the temple became. But this critique in 2 Samuel and 1 Kings has a counter in 1 and 2 Chronicles. When I was in seminary and studying the Old Testament, our professor would say that 1 and 2 Chronicles is like the national agenda story. This is of Israel. And so here in Samuel and Kings, you get kind of the critique of it. And Chronicles was written later, and it gives kind of it supports the nation. So you don't have any critique of kingship, like kingship. Nobody, God isn't like, okay, I guess I'll let you have it. You know, this is a good thing. And Tony sets forth in Chronicles, it gives this sense that David, doesn't give a sense to David, it tells us that David creates the plans for the temple. So David is really the one who's constructing the temple, even though Solomon builds the temple. David has his hands in it all the way through. Mm-hmm. And he has his bloody hands in it all the way through.
You get a story of God critiquing the notion of temple altogether. But then you get a story from after the exile, mm-hmm. When there is stability and a sense of national pride. And you get a sense of a story written by rulers who want to keep the people in the mindset that authority is good. And you do that by whipping up a patriotic fervor, right? Mm-hmm.
It's almost propaganda. That might be a little too far to say, but it is. It does have that sense of propaganda because there's really no criticism. This is all pro-David stuff, pro-temple, pro-kingship that you get. Although Chronicles has to say that the kings end up falling away from the way of God. So there is that critique there.
But you can say that because it doesn't really matter what the individual kings do. They'll have this symbol of authority and stability and the nation as a whole, whatever the individuals may do. It's very much like this sense of patriotism, regardless of who's in office, a sense of my country, right or wrong. Well, it's okay to critique the presidents. In fact, that's patriotic because we know that America is America no matter who's in charge, because America is the people. But it's not even so much the people as it is the flag, baseball, apple pie, you know. Military.
I love baseball and apple pie. It's awesome.
There's nothing wrong with it, but that becomes more important. Right. All these symbols become more important than both the nature of the rule and the people who live under that rule.
One of the other things that Tony brings out that's really cool, and Rob Bell does this too in his book, Jesus Wants to Save Christians, where Tony talks about how Solomon in 2 Samuel and 1 Kings creates the temple through forced labor, which is remember in the very first episode and the first story we talk about the Exodus and leaving and how we don't go back to the ways of Egypt. And here we have Solomon building the temple through forced labor, which is what the Egyptians did.
Yeah, exactly. The symbol of national stability goes against the very founding of Israel as a people. We remember that Israel is made up of the Hebrew people who were the Hakeru, who were the displaced, the marginalized, the oppressed. That was their identity, was their shared experience of oppression. But when they get a chance to have some power and some stability, you know, the whole point is that God was with them when they were oppressed. But to feel God's presence in their prosperity, they can forget about their time of oppression and forget about the people that God wanted them to be and the blessing that God was to them when they were the oppressed and the marginalized and the dispossessed.
One of the things that Tony brings out really well in this book, and he does it like in these really brief paragraphs, is gives us a Girardian understanding of the temple.
His brief recap of Girardian theory is just so brilliant in its efficiency and economy of words. I mean, I can read the first paragraph of that because it is just so fast. So, brief recap of Girardian theory. It says, primitive humanity emerged in the context of the killing of a scapegoat who was blamed for the ills of the group and then suddenly became the source of the group's newfound peace and prosperity through discharge of group violence. These sacrificial benefits were enormous and they were constantly in demand. New crises of mimetic desire, that means everybody desiring what everybody else desires because we all learn from each other. And so we see what someone else wants and we want it. So new crises of mimetic desire and rivalry constantly afflicted the group. Some produced externally through things like food shortage, drought, plague. So everyone wants what there is little of, like food, water, and health. Not that you can really fight over health, but others internally through competition for status, women, food, etc. Every time a crisis boiled over, there would be a new victim, providing the only way to resolve things at this primitive level and go forward as a group. So people would gather around, kill a victim, and then feel better, like magic. And it's because they all came together to agree on the source of their problem and rid themselves of that problem. And that makes everyone feel good. And if no one questions it, then they can keep feeling good for a while until the next crisis arises. So along the way, it is possible many groups succumbed to chaotic violence and did not find the surrogate victim. In other cases, the group spontaneously discovered that killing an animal would have many of the benefits of the human victim and what is, of course, much less dangerous to the group. The killing was mimetically linked to the sacred character of earlier human victims. So in this brief paragraph made longer by me trying to explain. But in this brief paragraph, we have a sense of violence at the very foundation of humanity and how people came to have conflicts over their desires, resolve their conflicts by blaming the same person or group and killing them, and then how that evolved into animal sacrifice. It's really the quickest I've ever seen that done.
Yeah, it's great. So this is where we get the ambivalence of the sacred, as René Girard would say. And this, and what he means by that, it's, Tony says this here on page 178, is that the ambivalence of the holy is that it seeks peace, but also unleashes violence. And so this is where the sacred comes in, Violence in the Sacred, Girard's major book, where the way to peace is to channel our inner hostility, our conflicts amongst one another against a scapegoat. And it gives us a temporary sense of peace. And over time, this gets ritualized and eventually becomes associated with God and God's desire for us to achieve peace. And the way that we do that is through channeling our hostilities against a scapegoat. And this gets ritualized in the temple. And this isn't just Judaism that has this. This, as Tony points out, this is seen worldwide. Yeah. And so as the thing that Judaism does that's so fascinating to me is you get these critiques that this is not what God desires. And this is Tony going into the second part of this story where you have the prophetic critique of the temple. So you see this in Hosea, where it says that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. You see this in Jeremiah, where it appears as though God is saying, I never commanded you to perform these sacrifices. That wasn't me.
The prophetic critiques of the sacrifice within the temple they're just amazing. Amos, Hosea, Jeremiah, Isaiah. It's all really stunning. I was particularly intrigued by Isaiah 66, 1-3, because it says at some point, whoever slaughters an ox is like one who kills a human being. Whoever sacrifices a lamb is like one who breaks a dog's neck. And Tony points out that there's no word for like in Hebrew. That gets shoved into our Bibles to make it a little easier and maybe even a little more palatable for us. But it's actually saying whoever kills an animal kills a human. And of course, we know that killing a human is wrong from the Ten Commandments. But again, I mean, we know that the Bible says it's wrong from the Ten Commandments, among other places. It's wrong anyway, but you get this sense that violence is good and violence is bad within the same Bible. So you have this internal critique. I mean, the reason you get the sense that violence is good is because people thought that for a long time, because it really did bring them peace. That's the paradox of humanity, that violence did come through peace, but it was still violence. And the more peace you got from violence, the more uncritical of violence you can become, and the more dependent you become on violence.
And the more dangerous
you really are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the more dangerous violence becomes, because you keep having to up the ante of violence to create peace, which is not true peace. It doesn't lead to lasting peace. It's just this temporary peace until you have to use violence again. So that's why Hosea says God desires mercy, not sacrifice. And that means sacrificial violence. And in the third story, Jesus picks up on this prophetic critique. And this is so important. Like you just mentioned, this is so important. These multiple voices within the Bible. We often think that the Bible has one voice, God's voice, and it goes through. But Second Chronicles, as we discussed earlier, and Third Isaiah, Isaiah 66, were written at virtually the same time. And so when Second Chronicles is giving this like pro-temple ideology, Third Isaiah is critiquing it. So there, these multiple voices are existing at the same time, and they both make it into the Bible. And which voice are we going to choose to live into? Mm-hmm. Jesus chooses to live into the critique of the temple, the critique of sacrificial violence. And so he picks up Hosea twice in the Gospel of Matthew and says that God desires mercy, not sacrifice. And Tony spends quite a bit of time talking about Jesus entering into the temple, not to cleanse it, as so many people think, but to stop it, to stop the function of sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. The cleansing of the temple could be heard in two different ways. It could be the cleaning out the temple, or it could be cleansing humanity of the temple. So which way do you interpret it? You know, I hadn't even thought of the second way until I began to study Girard. And
Jesus, Tony says, his actions at the temple renders sacrifice impossible, because he creates this whip. And many people say that this is a violent act, but Tony says that it's a prophetic act, because you create a whip and you start whipping at animals, and they're going to start running away, getting out of the temple. And so nobody can purchase these animals anymore for sacrifice.
Right. So his even driving out the animals from the temple is an act of mercy, because the animals will no longer be killed. So when that realization hits you, I mean, people use this to say, look at how angry Jesus got. How can you say Jesus didn't believe in violence when he used violence at this point? And what he was actually doing was saving the lives of the animals, but he was also saving the lives of the people from the sacrificial system. A lot of people point to the greed of the money changers in the temple and the fact that sacrifice was basically very hard to afford, and yet the people had to do it anyway. So it certainly broke the people economically, and that is inextricably tied to their survival, their livelihoods. If the only animal you can afford to purchase is one that you must sacrifice, and you can't even feed yourself and your family with it, then you probably don't have much longer to live, really. Mm-hmm. So, yes, he's saving the people from the economic exploitation, but also the idea that we need violence to survive, that we need, first of all, the idea that it is violence. I mean, that's where we're so blind. If it's ritualized, if it's animals, if it's in the right place at the right time with the right tools, then it's not violence, right? Mm-hmm. That's the way we think. But it is. It's still violence. It's still blood and death and pain. And there's the idea that God needs this and wants this in order for us to be forgiven. Forgiven for what? For the blood and death and pain that we cause each other. Mm-hmm. It really makes no sense, but we don't think about it this way until we do. And once you see it, you can't unsee it.
So. Yeah, and that's the point about forgiveness that Tony makes so clearly in the book too, is that Jesus renders the temple obsolete because he goes around forgiving people. Mm-hmm. That was the good function of the temple, was this sense of, oh, I'm now forgiven because I've done this. But as you say, it's this circular argument of, oh, I have to spill blood in order to be forgiven, and God has to forgive me for spilling blood, and so I have to spill more blood. So Jesus is just like, you don't have to do that anymore. You're forgiven.
Yeah.
And he gets this from within his Jewish tradition. He's not like going against Judaism for doing this. He's standing within the prophetic critique that God desires mercy and not sacrifice. You're already forgiven. God is already merciful.
Exactly. What I really love about the Girardian lens on all of Scripture is that it does point out the prophetic critique of these institutions like the temple. But what Girard also does is give us a sense of why people got it confused, why people got it wrong, why people thought they needed a temple, why they thought they needed sacrifice, and why they thought that the command for sacrifice came from God. Because when your life is in crisis and then it's resolved with violence against someone who isn't you, and you feel that sense of relief and that sense of connection to everyone else who feels that sense of relief. And you get the sense from that peace that you sense, you get the sense that God wants peace, even as you get the sense that God wants what you won't even call violence, but that's what it is. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense of so many things that just really don't make any sense if you don't have that crucial piece of information, if you don't have the self-reflection, because this isn't just about what some weirdos were doing thousands of years ago. This is about what we continue to do today. I was thinking about the centrality of ritual and how deeply it affects us today, and how sometimes our rituals, even though they're so entwined with our values, how the symbol can override the real humanity and lose all meaning, even as we fight so hard to defend it. And I was thinking about Colin Kaepernick and all those who kneel, and how so many people get angry because they're defiling the sacred ritual of the national anthem before a football game. And for all the outcry, you get the sense that that ritual is super sacred to America. It represents loving the country. It represents honoring our soldiers who sacrifice for love of the country. And yet, what Colin Kaepernick is doing by kneeling, or what he did do by kneeling, and what others did following him, was a love for the people of the country so great that he called us out on our ideal. He called us to live into our ideals of liberty and justice for all, and live into the image that we have of ourselves. And I mean, I just saw a parallel between Jesus tearing down the temple, like shutting it down, in order to remind Israel of who Israel was. And Israel's identity was caught up in the temple, so that they thought Jesus was attacking them, but he was trying to free them to be the people that God called them to be in the first place. So I saw that parallel as I was reading. And I am probably sure that many people have already seen that parable. It just struck me reading this again. Struck me reading this, but I don't think I've said anything that many of you haven't already thought. So,
no, it's a great connection. I love it. It's powerful. I like what Tony does with the Eucharist, particularly. Yeah. He does this at the end, particularly where he says, you know, the temple is the place of the holy, and the Eucharist, Instead, the Eucharist works to transform the ordinary and unclean into a space where God gives himself in love. The whole earth is transformed. There is no longer clean and unclean, nowhere where God is not. And this is like the Eucharist is everywhere. God is giving God's self through these elements, these very earthy elements, through wine and bread, and giving God's self to us.
It's beautiful. I mean, when you think about the Eucharist and you think about the Last Supper, it's hard not to think about the violence that occurs upon Jesus right after the Eucharist. And so there is still violence, but it's our violence. We humans are the ones who tear Jesus apart. And Jesus breaks the bread and says, "This is my body." He's breaking his own body, and he gives it to the people, and he says, "Eat this in remembrance of me." And the word "remember," member, put back together, you know, take a piece of me into yourself And then you become my body and you come back together after you break me. Take me into yourselves and come back together again. You know, the forgiveness is in the putting back together. That we receive forgiveness by, you know, the forgiveness is freely given, but our job is to receive it, take it into ourselves, and unbreak ourselves, put ourselves back together. You know, all the things that join people together: mercy, compassion, love, cooperation, community.
Yeah, fantastic. So that is that. Those are our reflections on the temple and its deconstruction. Next week at 10 o'clock Central, we will be talking about the seventh and final story, which is history to its end. So that's a big story.
Yeah. That sounds like everything, literally everything.
History to its end. So we hope that you will join us live here on Any Meeting. The links will be made available on the Raven Review website and on the Raven Foundation Facebook page. So join us next week for that. And you can stay up to date on all things Raven Review on the Raven Foundation Facebook page and at ravenfoundation.org. So until next week, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.